Welcome to KABU, Grace Dillon.
Thank you so much, Janice, for having me on for another conversation. Che McGwich, thank you very much.
Well, this Friday, April 22nd, is Earth Day, a day of global action that began 70 years ago, or more than 70 years ago, with the emerging environmental movement on April 22nd, 1970. An estimated 20 million people nationwide attended the inaugural events at tens of thousands of sites, including elementary and secondary schools, universities, and community sites across the country. Over the past 70 years, throughout the history of Earth Day, corporations, including oil companies and other polluting industries, join arms in declaring their love for the planet. So, Grace Dillon, how do we reclaim Earth Day, and particularly informed by the important leadership role and frontline activism of Indigenous communities, not only in this region, but around the world?
There have been so many exciting Indigenous climate justice movements that are going on of their own accord that it is just really, really exciting to see. One thing I just wanted to mention in my own language, Jaksawag Wesenika, animals are running out. Gigun Winazawag, the fish are dirty. Gawin Binak Zizano Nebish, it's not clean water. And we even have moments, Gibakwa, places where the water has become blocked up. And in our Anishinaabe philosophy, by recognizing all of these things, by being around our animal nations, insect nations, all around our Mitsukomikwa, our Mother Earth, we realize in Enewenden that everything in life is interconnected, that Gakina Awiwa, we are all related. And in that process of recognizing that Gakina Awiwe, we are all related, many, many tribal nations and people, activists and school activists within those tribal nations are not only implementing, and in Indian country, there was a recent lengthy special article on how so many of our indigenous nations, not just mine, because I knew about mine, are putting in solar power and putting in different forms of gardening that is very much connected to our indigenous sciences, which, as Isabel Stenger has suggested in when it was translated from French, she suggested slow science. And slow science is, you know, taking your time, observing, noticing. If there's something that you have to correct, then you go ahead and correct that, but you take your time. And in our Indigenous Futurisms novels, there is now more and more of play with this kind of form of climate justice. And by climate justice, I mean not that a group or community is necessarily helped out by others. That can happen. You can have partnerships. But rather that you start with your own selves. You start with your own community. And so the methods of what have come to be known as permaculture in some areas, I grew up doing that with my family. We didn't have a name for it, but today we would call that Indigenous sciences. So knowing all of that, it becomes, and the stories of Indigenous futurisms themselves, when they're talking about global weirding, and that's the expression I prefer to use after we just had the latest recorded snowfall here in Oregon.
Yeah, you're referring to the shift in language, global warming to global to climate crisis to climate emergency to climate catastrophe, expressing, of course, or registering an escalating sense of alarm, which is a good thing, although there's only so far we can go with the semiotics of this. But can you say
right.
how you prefer this term, global or climate weirding, as a way of signifying something going on that's palpable to people?
Right. Well, global weirding came in as a term that was used for novels that were really, really climate conscious, such as Jeff Vandermeer's, and where you have it just is up and down and side to side and doesn't come in a particularly kind of flow, right? So global weirding is you could have a weirding occur at any kind of moment.
You mentioned the unusual, unprecedented, the word of the era, unprecedented snowfall in the Western states, particularly here in our region last week, in mid-April.
Yes. Yeah, where our blossoms for apple trees and plum trees and cherry trees had already floated down.
Yeah.
Before the snowstorm.
You know, Grace, I'd like to get back to a point you made earlier and have you expand on it. I think many non-Indigenous communities, particularly climate activists, are somewhat familiar with the tragic side of Indian reservations in this country as places of, you know, with water shortage, poverty, tremendous social problems that carry the history and the moral debt to Native people that still has not been paid by this country. But you're also referring to the ways in which tribal communities and Indian reservations are places of very innovative experimentation and kind of what we used to call prefigurative communities of finding ways of building sustainable practices as models for the larger society.
Yes. Well, and what I was going to say is that Indigenous futurisms, when the novels, stories, films, TV, whatever it is, whatever form of art it is focused on sharing Indigenous sciences and ways of being and our ways of knowledge, Yikandasalan, and even our sacred ways sometimes, given with permission, Adazukanan, that actually, the story itself becomes a form of climate justice. So for example, Wobegashig Rice, who's Anishinaabe like I am, has written a novel called Moon of the Crusted Snow, and he's actually busy finishing up a sequel to it. And in this instance, came from the Canadian side, but has become very popularized globally throughout the world at this point. And what he does is the story is about a Native community, fictional Native community, but very strongly based on what he grew up with and what he saw. And they experience a power outage. And they also, as they search for, you know, where is this power outage and how far does it extend? Are we the only ones being affected by this? They're not able to make any kind of contact with the outer world, in a sense. And so they are on their own reserve, it's in Canada, and are suddenly having to make do And it's wintertime, moon of the crusted snow. And they're suddenly having to figure out how to help each other in a under some pretty scary circumstances. And so they band together and tribally, and they are doing their practices, and they're renewing some of their practices of first of all, as you hunt and trap and go out into the bush, that when you whatever you bring back, you share with the elders first, and anyone who might be incapacitated to a certain degree. And then you even share with your enemies. That's a very important part of this, is anyone that has perceived you as an enemy, or you have perceived them as an enemy, you feed them first, and then you feed yourself last. And by bringing back these traditional practices, they're able to form such a strong community that when you have, and then I'll leave it at that, but you have two white men that mysteriously, two white strangers come in to the community. And the community is then much, much better prepared.
I was wondering if you could say a bit about the difference in the use of the past in more reactionary traditions. And I think conservatives are often associated with a recovery of the past and turning to the past in an idealized, as an idealized golden era, as a rejection of many aspects of modernity, which involve diversity, changing, challenges to hierarchy, patriarchy, racism, and the ways in which indigenous communities in this vision of a philosophy oriented toward saving the planet and creating a sustainable future, that there's a recovery of the past in a different way than these reactionary, backward-looking politics. Can you say a bit about that difference?
Sure. Actually, that's a really interesting question. And I was immediately thinking, I really was grabbing your word idealistic, that usually, with a pastoral age or a golden age that you're going back to, Frederick Jameson has talked about that kind of nostalgia, that late list stages experience. But one thing I would want to say is that when I grew up with tradition, tradition for us, and this is very Nish or Anishinaabe, or in our Anishinaabemowin language, and that is that tradition for us is ever changing and dynamic, and is always used in a practical sense. Gerald Visner is an Anishinaabe professor. He calls it natural reason, where you use natural reason. And but you also use stories to basically overgo dominance, tragedy, and victimry with stories that celebrate, and by celebration, it can be simply engaging with what is going on, and that tradition itself, as I've always understood it, and as I was taught, and as it is in our language, is that it is ever-changing, quite dynamic, and much more in line with Octavia Butler's her work, such as Parable of the Sower or Parable of the Talents, where the things that you are learning and relearning, you are sifting through, and you're taking and using what is going to be very practical and will actually work during your own time.
And it may be the oral traditions that come out of kind of hunting and gathering modes of subsistence or modes of production place people as storytellers in their communities in a more active role in the transmission or reproduction of stories. So it's not the same as conservative hierarchical traditions where you're reading the text and interpreting the law from above handed down to you, but the indigenous cosmologies have a much more animated and dynamic universe of spirits and forces that engage people in a different way than how we think about the traditional texts, perhaps in the Judeo-Christian histories, although of course they vary there as well.
Well, and along with that idea is the idea of temporality and ephemerality being very, very recognized, so that you're used to adaptation. We had many, many moments of adaptation. But as you do the adaptation, you are also kind of sizing up what is it that you want to stand firm on? What is it that is important to retain? And one of the words that we have loved to use a lot in Indigenous Nation Studies is the expression resurgence, so that it's not that you just simply go back and, you know, try to reduplicate the way it used to be, you know?
Which of course is itself a lost cause, but you're talking about it, maybe a more dialectical way of thinking about the past, particularly with so many elders and traditions wiped out. It's a very different proposition than for the dominant society to recover its authority based on very old laws by white patriarchs.
Yes.
So can you say a little about this concept of resurgence?
Sure. Decolonization is recognizing that the Anthropocene has taken place for certain communities along the way, not just Native and Indigenous communities, but many in African countries, in India, all over. So recognizing that we have been in an anthropocenic times and experienced that ourselves and made it through and survived. And we have not only that, but survivance, where we have a joy and a celebration and storytelling of climate justice that invites in everyone. Gakina Wiwe, we are all related. You know, once you know who you are, that's the way it's set up for us. Once you know who you are and your family, then you can more generously become interconnected with others and provide a kind of mutual aid. And I do use Peter Kropotkin's term in a sense that is real, because in my Anishinaabe community, we grew up reading Peter Kropotkin, his mutual aid, and because it fit and matched our perceptions of pacifism and pacifist anarchy, some people call it, because they don't see the subtle layers of leadership and help and aid that's going on. But
well,
that's research.
Well, I look forward to having you back again and again and again on the Olmal Variety Hour on KBOO. I think you're drawing on Anishinaabe work and experiences, the tradition of Indigenous futurisms, a term that you coined, and you generously gather up and cite so many other works in this field. And I think all combined, you've given us a beautiful message for Earth Day. Thank you so much, Grace Dillon, for being with us today.
Che Miigwech, thank you very much for listening and sharing yourself as well.